This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when the World Health Organization released a statement on potential immunity to the coronavirus. They wanted to address a common question. If someone gets COVID and then recovers, are they immune to the coronavirus? After all, that's what happens with so many other viruses, right? And more urgently, the WHO wanted to address the question of so-called immunity passports. That's a kind of document or way of identifying that you might carry to demonstrate you've recovered from COVID and you're now free to move about the economy. The WHO statement was meant to make it clear that we're still waiting for evidence. That's all. Instead, headlines around the world took their statement in a different direction. Some sample headlines: sick with COVID, WHO says don't expect immunity. WHO says evidence points against coronavirus immunity. WHO finds no evidence that COVID patients will become immune. Yikes. With those headlines, you'd think that the World Health Organization had performed extensive research and concluded that, sorry, you won't gain immunity from this one. But the organization followed up with a new statement after all of those headlines. Quote, earlier today, we tweeted about a new WHO scientific brief on immunity passports. The thread caused some concern, and we would like to clarify. We expect that most people who are infected with COVID-19 will develop an antibody response that will provide some level of protection. What we don't yet know is the level of protection or how long it will last. We are working with scientists around the world to better understand the body's response to COVID-19 infection. So far, no studies have answered these important questions. End quote. And so the WHO is saying, no, we're not ready for immunity passports yet, but they're also not saying that you won't get immunity if you get COVID. In fact, Dr. Anthony Fauci told Trevor Noah that he would bet a lot of money the average person will get at least a year of immunity just based on our history with viruses, but we've got to know for sure with data. So why did the media bungle the WHO's initial statement? It's something about absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, but we don't really do nuance very well, and so the WHO learned a lesson about the value of clear communication. And here's a little irony. It was the WHO who created the term infodemic. They're concerned about bad information spreading during a crisis, whether it's deliberate or not. So the value of clear communication is absolutely prime during these kind of moments. Well, meanwhile, researchers are wondering if the educational system could be revamped to better teach us about how science works, how statistics can be better understood, what studies do and don't mean. Let's discuss that. I want to welcome back a guest whose visit was cut short last week because Governor Cuomo kind of goes on his own time, and we respect that. And Dr. Mario Alai is a physician based in Ontario, Canada, who's back with us on the program today. Doctor, thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me again, Evan.
Also with us is Stephanie Townsend, who's the Director of Research and Analytics at Rock the Future and a member of the Pittsford Town Board. Welcome to you, Stephanie.
Thanks so much, Evan. It's a pleasure to be back.
And hello to Barney Ricca. Barney is a professor in the Department of Mathematics, Computer Science, and Statistics at St. John Fisher College. Barney, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Well, let me start with Stephanie's comment that sort of sparked us to take a fresh look at this, because in the aftermath of that sort of that questionable headlines about the WHO statement, Stephanie, you tweeted the following. The pandemic is underscoring something many of us have been concerned with for a long time, the erosion of scientific literacy. Understanding the scope, limits, and process of science is critical to an informed citizenry and electorate. No one study proves anything, end quote. But let me kind of ask you if you think we've seen an erosion of scientific literacy or we've never really taught it as well as we should have. What do you think?
That's a great question, Evan. I suspect that we have probably never taught it as well as we should have. But now in this era, not only of the pandemic, but of so much information being at our fingertips, I think that it is becoming a bigger and bigger issue that misinformation, misinterpretation, misuse of information can fly so quickly, especially through social media. So I feel like it is having a bigger impact than it once did. I think also our attention span as consumers of media has possibly eroded as well. And the willingness to take the time to read the in-depth articles from the New York Times or the Atlantic or choose your media outlet versus the 140-character social media posts that you might see someplace.
Mm-hmm. Barney, what do you make of the way the public consumes some of this kind of information and whether it's sort of getting worse or better?
I would agree with Stephanie in that we probably have never done a good job. There have always been some excellent science teachers, but the science system, the science education system, really hasn't been focused on the process of science. And as we've gotten a much more complex society, we need to understand more about the limitations of science. We need to understand more about these nuances, which are the process we've never taught. And so I think the problem is getting worse, not because science teaching has changed, but because the society has changed.
Okay. And as we go throughout the hour, we're going to ask our guests to sort of create a roadmap. I mean, if we're going to go into the educational system, when do we start teaching about everything from the scientific method to things like availability bias, confirmation bias, motivated reasoning? You know, when do you start? And should we inject that more commonly into educational platforms, into classrooms? Maybe that's happening more than I think. I don't think it's happening very much, but we will talk about that as we go throughout the hour. Dr. Elia, I will tell you that as a reporter and as a journalist, my goal is not to sort of shame anybody. I had a lot to learn myself on how little I know about studies. So the media loves to like put a headline that says, study says XYZ, study says, and you know, I think those who communicate science are in a hard spot because if you were involved in a study and you have to create conclusions that are digestible for the public, you might condense it. But most of us who are journalists are not really trained in how to understand it. And the example that I always draw upon is, years ago, I wanted to better understand drinking during pregnancy. Now, I'm not about to say that it's advised or sort of okay, but what I learned is most of the headlines and most of the study was on heavy drinkers, people who were already drug addicted to other substances. And for people who are wondering, like, can I do like one drink a week? Can I do like a half a glass of wine a night? It's not that the answer was yes. It's that there was hardly any data out there. And when you tried to kind of sift through it, I often found when I finally talked to scientists, the headlines did not match what the studies were saying. And whether it's on that issue or so many others, I tend to continue to find that when you really dig in, the headlines don't always match the studies. So who do you blame for that?
Well, so it's a great example with alcohol and pregnancy, because that's one where in the end, it's not the actual best scientific consensus right now is not an easy headline. Right, where it's not drinking in pregnancy is unsafe at any level. The answer is not that drinking in pregnancy is safe at any level. It's there's a lot of nuance in there, and it's tough to communicate that. I've read papers and papers on this, and to really adequately explain that actually is chapters and chapters of books to be able to explain that. So, we can't. I think it's unreasonable to expect. I'll throw any, your general journalist out there to be able to actually digest a lot of this and to be able to kind of clearly communicate it. Now, there are science journalists who this is their entire job is to do this. But it's tricky, especially we look at COVID right now, right? Every headline that every journalist is expected to be able to adequately explain to the public is the science item, right? You look at this morning. I'm not sure if you saw the study about remdesivir, the drug that's been looked at for COVID. Article in the Lancet this morning showing no evidence of benefit. How do we adequately convey that to the public? Do we convey that this morning that there's no benefit? Remdesivir is dead as a drug. Do we put it in the context of our best information right now is that remdesivir doesn't work? How do we? I'm a physician, and even I would have trouble kind of adequately communicating that to the public. So I think stepping back, I'm not sure if I've ever told you, my wife is actually a high school science teacher. So her and I talk all the time about, what are they learning? What are the teachers actually taught? Mm-hmm. What are they taught in terms of what they're, and I can tell you, there needs to be a huge overhaul in terms of what the expectations are in terms of teachers and what they teach and the curriculum. Because right now, when you ask the average person, what do you learn in a science class? I learned chemistry. I learned how to memorize the periodic table. I've learned parts of the cell, done a little bit of experiments where it's kind of a predetermined process to, do this experiment and you will get this result. We're talking high school science right now. And that's basically what people look at in terms of, their scientific journey through high school, where I would argue it needs to be completely revamped, where we need a strong focus on critical thinking, much stronger. It's more important for people to learn critical thinking and how to actually think of science, scientific issues critically rather than them learning all of your amino acids. So we need a huge overhaul, because it's one thing to teach someone that, you know, about climate change right now, right, and teach them about vaccines. But these are just one-offs, right? And rather than just providing them the answer to this question right now, which we can do, it's an information deficit model, and we can fill up their jug of knowledge. But we need to actually teach them before the next hot button issue that will come. And we're learning that with COVID, right? We've not given people the actual tools of how to think about these critically. And now they're getting all this information, and there's political slants and economic slants and all kinds of things. And people don't know how to think through these things because they've never been taught. So I think we need to go all the way back and start in the high school, start in the curriculums and start there.
Okay. It sounds like both the other guests want to jump in. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree that it's not that journalists need to be an expert on the scientific topic, but they need to know how to ask the questions. And I would say that starting that goes way before high school. I would bring this down to our pre-kindergarten program, where we need to be starting from that very young age of helping kids develop those skills of observing the world around them, asking questions, noticing what patterns they see, and even more importantly, noticing the exceptions to the patterns and being curious about that. I think a lot of us know that you know, 3- and 4-year-olds tend to be very curious. They are natural scientists. That is real science. That's authentic science. And so often what they're getting in middle school or high school, oftentimes not until high school, is cookbook science. Here's the instructions for the lab. Follow this and you will get the right answer. Well, scientists don't study something that we already know the answer to. We study. It is things that we don't know the answer to. And it is messy and it is circuitous and it's iterative. And that's authentic science. And that's what we need to be giving children from the youngest ages and building up as they develop.
I think in some ways, you know, you're thinking about the pre-K, even teaching kids at a young age, it's okay to say, I don't know. Like, it's empowering to say, I don't know, is a valuable thing to teach, because it takes hold pretty quickly once they move into grade school that, you know, it's good to have all the answers. And, you know, if they see adults not willing to admit they don't know, then it starts to look like weakness. Professor Rick, where do you start with revamping the way we teach some of these concepts?
Well, I think Stephanie's right in that we start with kids as soon as they start in school. Children know how to ask questions, and this is what they do with their world, is they ask questions about it, right? Every parent, it seems, has been annoyed by the kid who goes, but why, why, why? And there's an infinite train of whys they could ask. Instead of having to develop it, I think what we have to do is stop repressing it. Because early on in schools, you learn you're supposed to have the right answer instead of you're supposed to have interesting questions. And it's really the can you pursue interesting questions that will develop the skills the students need as both students, good students, and as scientists, and as just adults in a democracy. So we start very early if we can. It's got to start with asking good questions, letting the students.
And I'm looking at some email and phone calls already, so listeners wanting to jump in on this, how do you think we're doing as when it comes to scientific literacy? What would you change? How are your kids doing in understanding these concepts? Do you feel like you can evaluate news, especially as we learn about, as Dr. Elias said, some news on remdesivir today, or whether it's other therapies, understanding COVID, understanding the related issues? Would love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And Rich in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Rich. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Very good. Go ahead, sir.
This is a really interesting subject, and my question and comment was going to go a little different, but it's changed a little. We also, with our children, as they start becoming more and more inquisitive, we got to, like you said, you got to stop taking it out of them because of our ignorance. Like, say, for instance, when I was a kid, I would watch, and because a lot of people, they thought it was weird. I would watch a spider and how the spider would weave his web around an ant. And that's where my scientific inquisitiveness started. So as I watched it, I started watching, you know, I started noticing that when the web vibrated, the spider would come out. I remember this really distinctly as like an 8-year-old kid. And children are amazing in that way of learning. But to my first comment, not only do we have to learn how to teach it and stuff, but we have to learn how to use it. My quick example is yesterday I was at Ellison Park walking. I noticed that people weren't using enough distancing for what they were doing. Example, they're running around, the kids are yelling, people are jogging, people are sweating, stuff is coming out, you know, they're breathing hard and all this. So 6 feet is in no way enough spacing. As a society and as a, say, the county needs to learn how to educate. Maybe they should have someone, you know, educators in the park, be it, you know, whatever staff or whatever, talking to families, talking to people, explaining to them why these things happen. Because people are all over the park. They're doing all these things. They're running up and down trails. That is science. That's another way to use science. Science needs to be used in so many ways in our instruction and the way we allow our children to think. If a child is looking at a spider weaving a web around an ass, ask the child, why are they looking at it? Then get into the conversation. Don't say it's weird because why are you watching an animal kill another animal? There's so many ways that our children tell us they want to learn. And we use our adults' minds instead of looking at it from their perspective to just stamp it right out.
Yeah, Rich, two great points there. To celebrate the curiosity of kids and to view that as science, that's wonderful and amen. When it comes to the communication aspect, let me ask all of you, and I'll start with Stephanie on this. You know, Rich is saying that even something as simple as physical distancing is new to most of us. I mean, most of us haven't lived through a pandemic before. And so even that takes education, takes outreach. And that's much less complicated than understanding the latest trial on remdesivir and its implications or limitations. And so what Rich is saying is, for those of you in research, in science, you gotta communicate effectively with the public. Stephanie, I think of the work that you might do at Rock the Future or for other groups in the community, and when we think about ameliorating poverty. One of the things that happened in 2015 when the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative starts is, you know, the media, me included, we start asking, well, what should we expect in a year? And I remember Ed Doherty told me one time, the only thing you should expect is to have people telling you, stop asking me what's going to change in a year, because, you know, this is a long-term process. We had to have metrics, but, you know, we didn't really understand some of the goals, how deeply baked we've created the system of poverty. And so we needed good communication, and I think that we've generally gotten in that group. But how do you view the role of not just the research, not just to be a scientist, but then to accurately communicate that to the public? How do you do that?
That's a great question again, Evan, because communicating this is so often where things fall apart. I oftentimes think of this as translation. I will take sometimes, to me, simple, sometimes complex, numbers and research and analysis, and it's translating it into language that people can relate to, that doesn't lose the accuracy, but you don't want to lose them in so much detail that they can't relate to it. The 6 feet example in the park is actually a great example of this. It sounds like a very easy measure, stay 6 feet away from people. But most people don't have an experience of what 6 feet looks like. Unless you're in a construction or something where you're regularly measuring things in feet, and because our education system values getting the right answer rather than estimating, most people don't have that sense. So one thing I've been doing here in Pittsburgh is trying to give people sort of comparison analogies they can relate to. 6 feet is about the distance from the front to the back of a car. In Wegmans, you see this. They're saying stay one shopping cart away from people. You have to give people something that they can relate to, that they have an experience of. Otherwise, it's just an abstract number that doesn't mean anything to them. I think as well, I'm going to stick right now because it's on my mind, some of the COVID analogies too of, you know, trying to explain to people about, like, with reopening, why do we have to do that slowly one step at a time? We could get into a big mathematical modeling explanation, or you can do, the governor has used his open the valve, close the valve analogy. The analogy I actually like better, because more people can relate to, I think, or at least in my circles they can, is that as parents, when you're introducing your toddler child to food, you introduce one food at a time so that you can see how they react to it. If you introduce a whole bunch of foods at once, then you don't know what is causing the negative reaction. Same thing with reopening our economy. We have to open one thing at a time so that we can see what impact it has. So I think sometimes it is a matter of really distilling it down into analogies and basic explanations that people can have an experience of. I think the other key thing is, how do we visualize the data? That's something that I really work a lot at and I'm constantly trying to get better at with communicating data in my job with Rock the Future, is how can we visualize this? Because again, the numbers for many people, unless they're already someone who does a lot of quantitative work and for a living or in some aspect of their life, it's the visualization that tells the story, sometimes in a way that is more understandable than the basic numbers themselves. Hmm.
Professor Ricker, want to jump in there too? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what Stephanie said about experience is really vital here. We, a lot of times when we try to communicate information, we try to communicate a process, we're doing it to people who don't have the experiences that we have as the scientists. And if people don't have that experience, everything is very abstract, and it seems like, well, how does this apply to my life, or what matters here? And until we sort of give students experiences and allow them to have those experiences, it's going to stay very hard to communicate this sort of stuff. I'm not saying everybody has to go have a virus, but we have to say somehow there has to be some way for the students to understand, oh, this is like that. And without that sort of appeal to experience, I think the communication is going to be difficult, if not impossible.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Elia?
I loved what was said earlier about, you know, teaching kids to, you know, admit they're wrong, and to, because I think, you know, humility is a critical piece of early science education and even kind of conveying these principles to adults, because that's one of the ultimate underpinnings of science, is that this is our best understanding of a current problem, a current situation based on our current data, and put to people in terms of understanding a new issue that comes up, is that I tell them, before you make any judgments on this or try to interpret this, assume that you have no preference as to how this is to turn out. Right? And there's some practical examples right now with COVID where some would have kind of an implicit bias going in as to how they would want to interpret this issue. So to go into it, and it's tough for a lot of us, right? A lot of us want things to turn out a certain way, right? I'd love any study coming out with COVID to be positive, to show the effect of an intervention. I'd love climate change not to be real, because it's really inconvenient to make a lot of the changes that we're going to make. So we have to confront those biases when we look at the information and to digest things. And part of this is how people kind of how people explore the internet and how people consume information, and making sure they understand concepts like confirmation bias, which isn't taught very well. That the idea that if we seek out things that just confirm our biases, whether it's scientific or otherwise, are not going to lead us to the ultimate truth on a subject, which is the ultimate goal of science. That we have to seek out other sources of information, other high quality sources of information, not just simply sources of information that contradict something that we're looking for. So again, a lot of these things are important to educate people. You know, again, even pre-K up through high school. How do we teach adults who already have their current biases? Part of that is kind of shows like this. Part of it is there's some good books, good podcasts about kind of scientific literacy and understanding the way we think and confronting that. So it's a big process, but again, we understand now, given how important scientific literacy is in the middle of a pandemic, that these are things that we really need to focus on, because this isn't going to be the last huge scientific controversy that we run up against, right? These things are just going to keep piling up through our lifetime.
Yeah. So if you're on the phone, Anna Catherine, Katrina, Jack, we're going to take your calls after our only break of the hour. And as we go to break, as we talk scientific literacy, just think about the term, exponential growth? That's the term. So we've been talking a lot in the last month and a half about exponential growth of COVID cases. And by now, I think most of us have heard it enough that we've got a basic idea. Here is an example as we go to break that I'll read for you that just shook me, that I wish that I would have heard this sort of story long ago, or at least right at the outset of this crisis. And our guests have probably already heard it, but if you haven't, it goes like this. There's a story that a king loved to play chess, and so he summoned the inventor of chess to see him, and he said, you know, choose your reward. You know, what an amazing thing you've given us with this chessboard, the great pleasure we get from it. And the inventor said to the king, well, let's just put one grain of rice on the first chess square, and then two on the next chess square, and then keep doubling that, four on the next, and then eight, and then 16. And then just give me the rice that's on the board. And the king said, well, that's all you want? You could have anything you want. And the inventor said, that's all I want. And the king says, okay, and sends him away. And a week later, he's told that the man didn't receive his reward, so he brings his staff in, and the staff says, sorry, king, what he asked for, we couldn't get. By the time we got halfway through the board, that was more rice than exists in the kingdom. There's 64 squares on a chessboard. Start with one grain of rice on the first, then two, then four, then eight. What do you get to at square 64? 9 quintillion. That's how much rice. That's more rice than exists in the kingdom. And the king did what anybody, you know, would have done there if they were embarrassed. They thought he'd been outsmarted by the inventor, so he called him back in and he had him killed. He said, you can never outsmart a king. That's the lesson. The king did not want to learn. He just didn't want to be embarrassed. Doesn't that say something? That's exponential growth. That's what we've been trying to avoid here. And I thought that is a really interesting way to think about it. And I keep thinking about that chessboard and trying to avoid getting even halfway through that chessboard. Our guests are Dr. Mario Alaya, a physician based in Ontario, Canada, Stephanie Townsend, the Director of Research and Analytics at Rock the Future and a member of the Pittsford Town Board, and Barney Ricca is a professor in the Department of Mathematics, Computer Science, and Statistics at St. John Fisher College. Your phone calls after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, when we talk about reopening the economy in phases, what about summer camps? We talk to leaders from a number of camps in Western and upstate New York. We'll talk about what camps can and cannot do during a pandemic. In our second hour, talking to doctors and nurses on the front lines, people who treat COVID. We'll talk about their experiences and what they want the public to know in our second hour Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and as we talk scientific literacy, I have an idea for you. Why don't you head to WXXI News' homepage, WXXINews.org, and check out the forum that we did with actual scientific researchers right here in our community doing work on everything from understanding a vaccine process when it comes to the coronavirus and preventing COVID-19, also remdesivir trials going on. There are different studies trying to understand immune response. And we talk to researchers, and that special is right there on the homepage, WXXINews.org. That special on fighting COVID-19, that community forum, and we would love for you to check that out and share that, because that information, we've been hearing from people from the West Coast to Maine. The feedback has been phenomenal on that, and we appreciate that. Let's start working through more of your phone calls. Anna Catherine, go ahead. Hi, Anna Catherine.
Hi, Evan. I'm an agricultural extension educator with Cornell Agritech, so I am thrilled that you're having this discussion. I think it is absolutely important, and I agree with everything I've heard. But there's an aspect of scientific literacy that I think is often overlooked that I wanted to bring up, and that's the concept of weaponized doubt that Robert Proctor at Stanford studies. He pointed out that starting with big tobacco companies, in the last few decades, we've seen companies and politicians resorting to introducing doubt into conversations as a way to avoid facts that detract from their agenda. So that's how we get arguments like, oh, everyone's opinion is equally important, and, you know, a scientific theory is just another opinion, and then you get flat earthers and that sort of thing. So I wondered if your speakers could comment on that.
Yeah, Anna Kempton, thank you for that. That is a really important concept. And as I kick it to our guests, and I'll start with Professor Ricca, not to politicize, because this stuff shouldn't be political, but I heard a very interesting analysis of the way the White House tends to attack the media, science, expertise. The idea is if we as a society trust nothing, then everyone's on the same level. And everyone is given sort of an equal standing to have opinions and sort of rise beyond what should be expertise and knowledge. So that weaponization of doubt that Anna Catherine is talking about can be a political tool, if you tend to agree with that analysis. But it's also a very sort of important thing to understand when we're trying to look at what the public consumes. And Professor Ricca, I'll start with you. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very true. That doubt can be weaponized. But that's one of the sort of paradoxes people don't understand about the process of science, is we want to try something, but we at the same time want to disbelieve it. People think, oh, we go about proving hypotheses, and that's sort of the scientific method, but we never prove our hypotheses. We actually say, this is what I believe, and therefore let me see if it's robust against all the challenges I can put it up against. So we actively try to disprove our own beliefs. And when we find we can't do that with an objective test of any sort, then we say, well, I'm going to go ahead and keep believing this particular thing. This hypothesis is considered to be a good hypothesis. It's a law now. So scientists live with the fact that we always doubt ourselves, which makes it more difficult, I think, for scientists to communicate in this era where people do try to weaponize doubt.
Sure.
Because we realize that's part of science. And it's not a bad thing. It's just something we have to deal with.
Sure. But Dr. Elia, that is different. In fact, what Professor Ricca is saying is so important, understanding that doubt is part of science and questioning and challenging. But that is different than intentionally trying to convince the public, oh, see, well, their initial projection said X, and now here we are at Y, and therefore you can't trust anything. That seems to me to sort of be the weaponization of doubt that I would worry about, especially during a crisis like this. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and we see it with other kind of hot-button scientific issues that kind of bleed into a political realm. So we talked about vaccines, where people use that, you know, use comment that, you know, unless you can prove 100.000% safety on it, then all you need, it's not safe. We've not proved safety. Genetically modified organisms, so GMOs, the same kind of debate, you know, same kind of discussion there, where, well, you can't prove with 100% certainty that there's not a glimmer of a risk down the road. And like you said, weaponizing that. But your other guest was absolutely right that part of being an effective scientist is allowing for that chance to be wrong, right? For that further evidence to, you know, further greater evidence down the road to disprove our current best hypothesis. That's part of being a good scientist. So unfortunately, this is part of the back and forth that we'll always have with those who seek to utilize that honesty from scientists, and that these are the limitations that we have and they'll utilize that to continue pushing whatever agenda, be it political, be it economic, be it whatever, they'll continue to utilize that. Unfortunately, the antidote to that is not to change the scientific process. The antidote perhaps is more effective science, you know, science communication and to really harp on the fact that, you know, yes, we are not absolutely certain, but we have a high enough level of certainty to move forward. That's sometimes a hard pill for people to swallow, right? Right now, people are not happy with the fact that we don't have 100% certainty as to how this virus acts, how the best way to combat this virus is, and they're not convinced enough with that level of certainty that we have that they're willing to make certain certain concessions in terms of their lives. So, unfortunately, you know, antidote is to keep pushing again good science communication and distinguishing to people the difference. One other thing that we haven't really talked about is distinguishing the scientific process from the institutions of science. And I think sometimes people blur that a little bit, again, sometimes to make political points, but that, you know, this scientific institution has behaved malevolently, or this scientific institution isn't behaved, thus science is corrupt. So I think it's really one of the things, I saw Larry the Cable Guy on Twitter the other day ranting about science and how science is wrong and scientists just flip-flop. And again, part of that education that we need to provide to even people like Larry the Cable Guy is what science is, that it's a process, that it's not an organization, that it's not even a person, that it's not a company, that those are institutions of science, and they can be wrong, right? Institutions can be fallible, absolutely, and they need to held to account. But that being distinct from what science is.
Stephanie, I saw a conservative radio host say that because initial projections on COVID deaths might not turn out to be true, how can we trust that climate change is actually happening? I mean, talk about weaponization of doubt. Talk about not understanding processes.
Right. And that's where I think that both climate change, the COVID crisis, as well as what I deal with in doing research on education, is that there is a conflict there between the public oftentimes thinking that science is going to capture some objective reality that exists independent of human behavior versus human behavior being part of the equation. And with the pandemic and climate change, very clearly human behavior is part of the equation. So those projections that have been made, whether it is about the number of COVID cases we would see in the United States or the number of hospital beds we would need, those projections had to be based on certain assumptions that are translated into mathematical equations around how you and I and our neighbor next door were going to behave. And the reason in part in New York State that those projections ended up being higher than what we are seeing now is because we exceeded those assumptions. Not only in terms of government policy, but the way our employers responded, the way our neighbors responded, we have all done better at following those good public health behaviors than the models expected us to. So this is where it, you know, there is, these models are not some objective reality. They are an interaction between many different variables, including us and what we choose to do.
Let me get back to your phone calls, and I want to get Katrina in Henrietta. Katrina, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a science educator in high school for about 8 years now. But prior to that, I was actually a research scientist, so I have experience in both worlds. And I wanted to just highlight both some good things that have been happening in science education and some of the challenges. So one of the good things that has been happening is that the Next Generation Science Standards are a national set of standards that came out about 10 years ago. And states have been at different places in their adoption of these. But basically, they embed those science skills. They're supposed to embed those science skills from K all the way through 12th grade. So for instance, this would involve having students engage in argument from evidence, develop and use models, use mathematics and computational thinking to analyze scientific phenomena or observable phenomena and solve problems. So ideally, we should be seeing changes as people go through a system that is supposed to value these skills over factual recall or memorization. However, I wanted to highlight some of the challenges that us as educators face with this. So our schools, most of them, as they are set up, really tend to still reward factual recall and high scores on tests, which don't necessarily evaluate or properly assess these kinds of more organic skills that come through really students doing and being in the driver's seat. So I'll give you an example. If you look at like how schools get rated, especially in, say, the Rochester area, or what they tout as their achievements, usually they are high scores on standardized tests. Most of those tests really don't say much about how students do with these skills. So when educators try to do a better job of engaging students in science as a process and critical thinking, they often face some serious pushback from the system they're in. Students, parents, other teachers might say, oh, why aren't you, you know, doing a conventional test, or, you know, where are all the facts, or why is this more difficult than sort of a lecture-based class where I just spit back what the teacher says? So I think the shift to critical thinking in education lies not just with teachers, but with the whole community and the parents and the administrators and how we think about things like grades and tests and assessments. So I'm wondering if any of your speakers here have any experience with implementing sort of a more progressive vision of science schooling that actually allows students the places to take, to say, engage in arguments or analyze mm-hmm. or use models.
Yeah, Katrina, thanks for what you do, by the way. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And I'll start with Professor Ricca. What do you think? Do we have you, Professor Ricca? I lost you for a second.
I'm here still.
Yep, go ahead.
I used to be a high school, middle school science teacher down in Dallas, Texas. And one of the things we did one year was go to a very much a progressive science curriculum. And we got a lot of pushback from our parents about not having textbooks and not having traditional tests and all of this. And when we started talking to the parents and listening to them, it turned out that their concern actually had nothing to do with science whatsoever. It had to do with they wanted to be able to help their child, and because it was a different science than they had had, they were unable to do so without a textbook. And so they were concerned they couldn't help their kid when they were struggling at home. And so the issue was nothing to do with science. It had to do with community. So we had to do basically instruction with the parents. And so that point is, that teachers, yes, have to do this, but we do have to engage the community because they have legitimate concerns that we have to help overcome. The other piece is testing the process of science instead of testing the facts of science is going to be a lot more expensive. I've yet to see a really good, easily scored multiple choice test that tests process. And once you have to start hiring qualified people to grade the standardized tests, the cost of those tests is going to go up greatly. So there's a lot of interlocking gears on this one that are going to have to be addressed if we want to make these changes.
Okay. Stephanie Townsend?
Yeah, I sort of echo what Barney just said. And I think that, unfortunately, politically, when it comes to education in this country and in New York State, too often it is being driven by the test, which I find very interesting because, for example, one of our New York State regents, I have heard many times speak very passionately about how we need to move beyond simple multiple choice tests and that child development, that social emotional development, critical reasoning skills, thinking skills are far more important. Yet if one of our New York State regents who is part of setting the rules and the system for assessment expresses an opinion that is so diametrically opposed to what we're actually doing, it does make me a little pessimistic at times, and I'm someone who tends to be on the optimistic side. It makes me wonder, what is it going to take to have to change? So the example that Barney just shared is one I'm very familiar with, and
you know, it's a great example of what an individual school can do. There's another good example in one of the suburbs in Chicago where a school district said, we don't think that the what is required on the test at different grade levels is developmentally appropriate. We think that science should be taught differently. So we're going to do what we think is best for the kids, and we don't care that our test scores are going to be lower. They were willing to take that risk in the in the court of public opinion and to develop that support from their community to do that. But that's sometimes the kind of risk that I think it is going to take. And we're going to have to work our way up, I think, rather than waiting for it to be changed from the top down.
Dr. Elia.
It's interesting hearing the caller's experience as a science teacher. As I mentioned, my wife's a science teacher up here in Canada, and largely the same experience with kind of being hamstrung by the curriculum in a way, and again the other demands on their time. Interestingly, here in Canada, we don't have college entrance exams, so the limitations in terms of being kind of having to teach to a test necessarily don't exist, yet we still have the same inertia with things not moving in a direction that moves more towards kind of critical thinking and the kind of the process of science rather than kind of fact-based learning. So, you know, where is it going to come from? You know, I think, you know, at a school level, certainly you could see some innovation happening, and there are really good resources out there. There's a really great book. If teachers are listening and they're interested, the book by Clyde Freeman. It's actually a kind of a case series of examples that are meant to kind of teach students that, you know, here are cases, concrete cases of how scientists work through the process of a problem, and kind of some of the pitfalls they ran into and some of the issues that came about. And kind of using those in classrooms and having the students really engaged on those to teach them some of those cases. And we look at COVID. I'll get back to COVID. We have COVID denialism, obviously. There's an incredible lesson to be learned in HIV denialism if we go back. So kind of tying science and history and going through kind of old cases can really help. And that's kind of one of the ways that's been pushed to how to innovate high school and college level science classes. And my hope is that, again, it's going to have to come from grassroots pushing here in Canada, provinces at a state level or at a municipal level, pushing that curriculum development. And examples like the pandemic we're going through and hot-button issues kind of push that along, because we do get complacent, right? We get back to normal life and we forget how important kind of science is on a day-to-day basis when it's not, you know, right in our face every single day. But at times like this, that kind of may push curriculum developers to make some innovations.
30 seconds apiece. Let me just ask you all as we close the program today, getting reliable information. Dr. Elia, where do you get it from in the days of COVID?
So funny enough, and you've actually reached out to me about this too, you know, who's a good person to follow? You know, Twitter, oddly enough, is actually my place to go for high quality information because of the people I follow, right? I have an ecosystem on Twitter of highly respected professionals who are accountable, who I know I'll get quality information from. I do not use Facebook to get information, even from fellow physicians. I don't find that to be valuable. But for me, it's Twitter. And a lesson to the public, don't be afraid to ask people you respect and people who you know are objective for who they follow, because that will give you an insight into their ecosystem as well. And it's hugely valuable. It's not just following someone who's going to have your same mindset and share your same politics, whatever, but who in your life is objective? Who do you go to for straight shooting and highly good information, and find out who they're following.
All right.
Usually beneficial.
Great stuff. And we'll share his list, by the way, if he will share it with us listeners. Professor Ricca, 20 seconds, Professor Ricca. Besides public radio, where do you get good information?
I try to go any place where they can actually let me look at the data straight up.
Mm-hmm.
Being a statistician, I like to be able to look at the data and play with it myself. So Johns Hopkins made it available, the CDC, WHO, and several others.
Okay. Stephanie Townsend.
Locally, Dr. Michael Mendoza. Our health commissioner has been amazing at being a straight shooter and giving us the facts, telling us what we know, what we don't know, and I think he's been an incredible leader in this time.
I want to thank all of our guests here, and listeners, if we couldn't have time to fit in your emails or calls, tremendous interest in this subject, which I think is a wonderful sign that people want to keep expanding their understanding of how things work and how to communicate and how to sort of build a better world. We got a great email from Vancouver, Canada, where Dave said, this isn't just about science, this is about something that's essential to life and any real democracy. So thank you, Dave. Dr. Mario Elia from Ontario, Canada, a physician there, thanks as well for the time. Thanks for being here again.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks.
Barney Rick, a professor at St. John Fisher College. Thank you, Barney.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Stephanie Townsend, Director of Research and Analytics for Rock the Future. Thank you, Stephanie.
It was my pleasure, Evan.
And to the whole Connections team, Rob, Megan, Evan, we'll talk to you tomorrow.